Now, I'd like to introduce you guys to our main speaker of this evening, Dave T. from El Cajon. Welcome.
Alcoholic Dave Thomas. It's great to be back at this meeting. I spoke here a few times, and it's always a pleasure to come here. I was thinking before the meeting started that I asked my wife out on our first date at this meeting, and she turned me down. So it's kind of interesting to have her here and to be back and speaking here with her here. And it's interesting how this evolution of my life and sobriety has come. And the fact that today I have two kids and a wife and a busy life with a new business that I just started. And, my Alcoholics Anonymous life has changed. And when I first came in here, I went to lots of meetings and did lots of things, and now I don't get that. And it's awesome to be able to be in a meeting with my wife and have some recovery and to be able to stand up here and share how I got here, And for me, I believe that my disease of alcoholism was alive and well long before I ever took my first drink. I was irritable, restless, and discontent long before I did. I think that alcohol solved my problems, I can remember growing up and watching my dad drink and thinking that alcohol was terrible. And I hated what my dad did when he drank alcohol, and I hated how it affected him. And I remember telling my mom, I'll never drink like that. I never want to be like him. I know that alcohol is not ever going to be in my life because I can't stand what it does. And, I meant that. I knew that alcohol was not for me. And I think my spirit, I believe I'm a spiritual being having a human experience, and I believe that my spirit knew right away that alcohol was going to anesthetize it and it wasn't going to make me well. And watching my dad and seeing what alcohol did to him really made me never want to do that. And as all of you know, I introduced myself as an alcoholic, so something had to happen in there that convinced me that alcohol would work for me, that alcohol was going to do for me what it didn't do for him. And, I think that this story that I'm going to tell you tonight is really about me discovering the fact that I'm an alcoholic and discovering that I needed a power greater than myself to manage my life because my life became severely unmanageable left on my own resources and even became unmanageable long before I ever took my first drink. I tried to manage my life with the drink. That didn't work either. So to kind of get started on this journey, I can tell you that my earliest memories were of fear. I had fear from day one. Fear ran through my life. I was scared to death. I had a pending doom from my earliest memories. And I remember, going to school and feeling like I was going to have something bad happen. I was scared to death of the other kids in my class. I was scared to death of my teachers. I could have easily used a drink in preschool. I know that would have worked on that situation, in school, I seemed to have learning disabilities, so I never quite fit in. I always was in special ed classes. My mom had to always come to school and, fight for me to get through each grade. I think I even got held back in first grade because I wasn't mature enough to move on or wasn't at the reading levels. So I always felt less than in school. And by the time I was in junior high, I was very fearful about going into high school. And this is my first real memory of how this disease works. And when I graduated eighth grade, I was told that we were going to have to take showers when we got into high school. And so for the whole summer between eighth grade and high school, all I could think about was the fact that when I got to PE class that I was going to have to take a shower and everybody was going to know that I wasn't physically mature and I was this, undermatured kid. And every day, that's pretty much my main thought, every day. And by the time that summer ended and school was going to begin, I was like physically sick on the morning that I woke up to go to school because I was so fearful of what was going to happen. And I got to school and walked into my, first class and got my schedule. And, of course, my PE class was, like, towards the end of the day. So I got to walk around school all day and think about it and worry about it. And, I remember my first period teacher making a joke about the fact that she was calling our names. And she called me and she said that the middle school was across the street because I looked so young. And that just like fed fuel to the fire, you know. And I don't even know if that's true, but that's what's in my head, you know. That's the way that, like, that's what I heard. And that's how I perceive it. And that's how, you know, my craziness and my brain works. And so anyways, I get into PE class, and the PE teacher gives us our, you know, kind of tells us what we're going to be doing, and then takes us in and assigns us lockers where we get our PE clothes and stuff, and says, you know, this is our lockers, this is our locker room, and there's showers in the back, and you can either take a shower if you want to or you don't have to. And I got my first resentment, really, at that guy right there, because I put so much effort into that worry and remorse, and it didn't even exist. You know, I, like, wasted a whole summer thinking about something that didn't even exist. And I know today, if I would have drank that summer, I probably wouldn't have had a bit of worries about it, you know, because alcohol did that for me. And it wasn't until I was in high school that I had my first drink, and I was in special ed classes, and I remember some of my friends saying, hey, you want to come over to the park after school and hang out with us? And when I got over to the park, they were passing around a bottle and a joint, and when it came to me, I took a swig, and when it came to me, I took a puff, and next thing you know, all of my fears and all of the stuff that kept me from being a part of everybody else went away. And it did something for me that it must not have done for my dad, because I became happy. I wasn't angry. I wasn't all of those things that I watched him do, you know. And I'm an alcoholic, but drugs are part of my story, and I believe that alcohol comes in pill, powder, and liquid form, and you can even smoke it, and it works like that for me. So, you know, it was easier to get drugs when I was in high school than it was to get alcohol, and it's just part of my story, but I'm an alcoholic. Alcohol was always in my life, and I have alcoholic part of me, so, you know, that's just the way it is for me, and so that's kind of my story. But anyways, you know, as I did that, I had fear of women before that day, and I started talking to girls after that, and I didn't drink every day after that, but I thought about alcohol every day after that. It became the obsession of the mind right off the bat. I believe that alcohol could do for me what nothing else could do. And, you know, all of a sudden I just realized that, hey, my dad had issues with alcohol that I don't have. And I worked for my parents in a glass shop. And we had a little race car. And I traveled around the country and I raced off-road race cars in a thing called Mickey Thompson. And at that time, I was, you know, probably a sophomore in high school, and I just got my driver's license, and I thought racing the regular car at school was just like racing my race car, and I ended up crashing behind the school and totaling the car a week after getting my driver's license, you know, and it's just like that kind of stuff that I would do, just those crazy, always trying to live my life like that, and about that time, I think we had won the lottery for $1 million. And throwing $1 million in the lottery on top of alcoholism didn't do me any good, you know. And the truth of the matter is we got like $30,000 a year for 20 years, and my parents owned a business. So really, the money just went into that and went into my race cars. And I didn't really change my life at all, but it changed my perception of the way that I conducted myself, the way that I hung out with other people. A lot of those friends that were my friends I stopped hanging out with, and I started going to the parties that I wasn't invited to, and I started believing that I was somebody that I wasn't. And alcohol did for me what I couldn't do, and that's to just like turn that part off of me that saw the truth and allowed me to be somebody that I wasn't. And, you know, I kind of came to the realization that I didn't like racing race cars anymore because it took away from my time of partying, and I'd have to go to practices and I'd have to do all these things, and really got in the way of what I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do is drink and party with my buddies. And so I just stopped going to those, you know, those things, and I told my parents I didn't want to race anymore. And around that time, I had a teammate, and his name was Jimmy Johnson, and he now has like 7 Cup titles in NASCAR, you know, and I was just as good as him and had every bit of potential that he had. I just chose to take the easier, softer way. I chose to not do what I had to do to be a part of that. And so I chose to go down the road of hanging out. And so I told my parents I didn't really want to work at the glass shop anymore, so we bought a boat, and I was going to run a dive charter business. And you know, a good thing about boats is you can drink on them. It's like, that's just accepted. It's just the way of life. So I drank a lot of beer, and I was going to get my captain's license, but I didn't really have motivation to take the test, and I didn't feel like I could pass it. So they hired me a captain, and he liked to drink, and we kind of worked on the boat and drank and did a charter here or there and really wasn't very productive in my life. And so I chose to, party on the boat. And it was around this time of the year, just a little bit before Christmas time. A friend of mine and me, we were down there drinking, and we decided the next day we were going to go out diving. And we went, got up in the morning, and I was hungover, and we went out to about just off of Point Loma in about 90 feet of water. And we set the anchor, and I started feeling sick. And I didn't want to throw up on my own boat and look foolish, so I just got in the water without my gear on right. And I went down about 90 feet, and I started having problems with my gear. And I started to feel like I was going to drown, so I made the decision it'd be better to die on the surface than to die at the bottom, and I dropped my weight belt from 90 feet. And unfortunately, the air that's in the human body can't come out that fast, and plus nitrogen forms as you come up that fast, and I had what they call an air embolism in the bends. And when I hit the surface of the water, what happened was is I had an out-of-body experience, and I'm not here to tell you that there's anything after this or whatever. This is just my experience, and when I hit the surface of the water, my body was there, but I came out of it. That's why I know I'm a spiritual being having a human experience, because that body wasn't anything to do with me. I was a spirit. I was energy. I was this form that came out of it, and there was this bright energy above me that pulled me towards it, that wanted me to I wanted to go to it, and when I got to it, I was met by other beings that told me it wasn't my time and that I had to go back, that I had to have this human experience, and I really didn't want to go back. That body really didn't look inviting on the water. It didn't look like something I wanted to go into, and I was pretty much encouraged that there wasn't a choice, that this is what I was going to have to do. And I got pushed back into this body, and the pain and the fear and the anxiety that come over you when you go back into your body after being out like that wasn't very good. And I remember screaming on the boat that I was going to die, but really what I was saying is I want to die because I don't want to do this human thing, And they were flying me to UCSD Medical Center to put me in a decompression chamber, try to push me back together. And on the flight there, the paramedic's going, "You're going to be okay, you're going to be okay." And I remember grabbing his hand and going, "No, I'm not going to be okay. I don't want to survive. I don't want to go through this." And we get to the place, and the doctor that puts me in the decompression chamber has never done this. He usually just treats people for like sicknesses and stuff like that with it. So he's not sure how to treat somebody. So he just puts me at 240 feet and tries to push me back together and give me oxygen to see what can happen. And my mom comes in, and she's looking through the portal, and I can see that she's upset because the doctor just told her, "The chances of Dave surviving are very slim, and if he does, he'll be brain damaged." So you can see I survived, but I don't know about the brain damage part. I think it was the alcohol, not the scuba diving act. Anyways, as you can see, I came through it, but I went through a lot. Every time they tried to bring me up, I'd have seizures. My heart would start to do weird stuff. The bubbles in my spinal cord would form, and I'd become paralyzed. Every time they tried to bring me up, but as I told you, I know that my angels, the beings that I met on the other side, really wanted me to get back in the game. They really wanted me to have this human experience. That they told me that I'd signed up for this, that this is important for me to go through, and so I think they helped pull me through it. And I think it's just wasn't my time, and I got through that, but what I didn't get through is the acceptance of doing this human journey. And it's funny that alcohol is called spirits because it definitely works on the spiritual malady that I had. And when I drank alcohol, all of that pressure of doing this human experience went away. And after that was over, I went through a lot of sickness, but what really happened was I found that alcohol just made it all better. And when I talk about alcohol, it was drugs too, because I kind of drugged and drank my way into oblivion, and by the time I was 22 years old, I was 90 pounds yellow, dying from this disease, and it was pretty bad, and I ended up going to a hospital and going into a rehab and trying all of that, but I wouldn't admit that I was an alcoholic. I wouldn't admit that alcohol was my problem. Drugs were my problem. Methamphetamine was my problem, but alcohol was not my problem. Alcohol was my solution, and I really had a hard time in there, and I got out, and I wouldn't go to meetings, and I went to some NA meetings, and I went to a couple AA meetings, and I showed up when it started, and I left before it ended, and I never got a sponsor, and I never worked the steps. I just did a few meetings and didn't drink, and I was angry, and I was miserable, and I went back to work at my parents' shop, and I hated the job, and I really didn't like what was going on, and one day I went over to my buddy's house, and he was drinking a Heineken, and he was smoking a joint, and I was like, good beer and good weed, that's not doing what I was doing, it'll be okay. And I took a drink of beer and I took a hit of weed and I was okay. It mellowed me out, it made me feel better. So that's what happened. I just started drinking beer. And next thing you know, I kind of went down that trail. And I don't know about any of you guys, but I don't really get into relationships. I don't know how to do relationships very well. What I do is I take hostages. And so I had some roommates, and we lived in La Mesa, and this nice girl came over to buy some stuff that I had, and I told her she didn't have to pay if she stayed, and I took a hostage. And we decided to make a little family, and we ended up getting a house out here in East County in Crest and outside the outskirts of El Cajon. And, you know, my skills of relationships weren't very good. And, you know, growing up in an alcoholic family, that's what I had, you know. Nothing against my mom and dad. They did the best that they could, but there was an alcoholic household. My mom's in Al-Anon. My dad needed AA, you know. And neither one were practicing any kind of program. And it wasn't a very conducive to a healthy relationship. So the tools that I had in my toolbox didn't work very well in this relationship, especially since I took a hostage and it was full of alcohol and drugs in that house. And, you know, I treated her a lot like what my dad treated my mom like, maybe even worse. And I remember back in 2003, the wildfires, you know, kind of like what we're going through right now with the winds and stuff came up, and there was a fire out east, and I woke up in the middle of the night and saw this orange glow, knowing that it was coming my way, you know? The impending doom of for sure, this is going to come and burn my house down. And I don't know if I invited it or if that's just the way it was, but the next day that fire showed up at my house, and I remember that girl taking her dogs and all of her stuff and packing it in the car and taking off, and I stayed with my garden hose and my Heineken, and I was going to fight a fire. And I think in my mind a little bit that, like, I really thought, well, if I burn up in it, it's kind of like a win-win situation, you know? I, like, get to go, and I don't have to do this anymore, or, you know, I save the house. But it showed up, and it was a little bigger than I thought it was going to be, and I'm a little more chicken than I thought I was, and I dropped the beer in the garden hose and ran and tried to get in the truck, and it wouldn't start, and it wouldn't start, and wouldn't start, and I'm like, oh, man, I'm going to burn up in my truck, you know? And the windows in my house had broken from the fire coming, and it for some reason let my truck start, and I drove out of there, and I was driving away, and I had my little bass boat on the back of my truck, and then the carpet on it caught on fire driving out of there, so I had to stop and put that out. And I drove down that hill, and I just knew that this was the beginning of the end, you know. I knew it was a pending doom. I knew that everything was going to change after this. And sure enough, that house burned down, and me and that girlfriend moved in with mom and dad and our two pit bulls, and we just had a quite a little household going at mom and dad's house. It was ugly, to say the least. And what ended up happening was somehow, some way, a power greater than myself decided to build a house there, and I don't know how to this day, because I'm watching my neighbor that still hasn't rebuilt his house after all this time, who we drank together all the time, and I'm watching them build this house, and somehow, some way, we built a house, me and my drunk contractor buddy, and we hauled off more bottles of alcohol and empties than we ever did any building materials, but we rebuilt a house in a little over a year. So there's got to be a power greater than ourselves working there, and it's a nice house. I mean, this house is awesome, and I'm raising a family in it today, but I get this house rebuilt, or I don't, something does. Me and my drunk buddy kind of stumbled through it, and it's time to move back in, and that girl doesn't really want to move back in with me, and so she ends up getting an apartment in Alpine, and I move back into that house by myself, and it feels like the walls are just coming in, and I just feel like I'm suffocating. And one night, I'm just trying to drink myself into to that comfort zone or to where I can pass out, and by that time, I'm drinking enough every day that when I wake up in the morning, I think I'm not going to drink, and by afternoon time, I'm starting to feel so sick that I have to go to the liquor store and buy some vodka just to calm my nerves so I can get through the day. So this night comes where, you know, I'm trying to drink myself into passing out, and it's not working. And I decide that I'm going to get in my truck and drive to Alpine, where this girl lives in an apartment, and have her fix me because she can make it better. And when I get there, she won't open the door. And when I finally get her to open up a little bit and I push open the door, she's in there with this other guy. And what I would have normally done on that night is probably got in my truck and drove through that apartment. But for some reason, I had no fight left. I had no belief, you know, in myself or in anything else. And I got in that truck and I went to go drive off the Pine Valley Bridge out east. And I had been out there a number of times in my life and looked at the side of that bridge and knew that if you went fast enough, you could drive right off the edge of that cliff. And I'd made up my mind this time that, you know what, I don't care. I'm not going to do this anymore. And I went into a blackout and I came to in a church parking lot in Alpine on my knees. And I didn't have any belief in a higher power and I didn't really do anything. But I think there's this part of me that finally said, if I can't get drunk and I can't get high and I can't die, then what the heck do you want to do with me? If there's something that you keep sending me back here for, what is it? You know, it's up to you. And I think I did a thorough first step right there. I surrendered to a power greater than myself and I gave it completely to that power. And for some reason, I picked up my cell phone and I called my parents and they came down and took me to their house. And that power that I surrendered to must have got to them already because they didn't fix it. They didn't try to make it all better. They called the police. And then I told them something like I was going to kill myself or kill somebody else. And they took me to Grossmont. And at Grossmont, I said the same thing. And they gave me a ride to this nice 72-hour vacation. And where I honestly believed that they were going to give me something that was going to make it all better. But I guess I surrendered to that higher power that got to that doctor before then. And he said, I don't give that to alcoholics. So if you want, I'll give you some Librium to help with your shakes. But you're an alcoholic, Dave, and I can't help you. And every bit of every good idea that I had went away. Because I really thought what I was going to do is I was going to go there, I was going to get some good drugs, I was going to meet a really nice girl, and we were going to finger paint and crafts every day, you know? Like that was a good solution for my life. That's what I had worked out best. But my higher power thought that the better solution was Alcoholics Anonymous, because what that doctor did is told me that that would be the only hope for me. And I didn't have the white light like Bill did, but what I did is I went and knelt down beside my bed and I just said, God help me, you know, I don't want to live like this anymore. And what happened was is I went to sleep and I was scared to death that the next day when I woke up that I would have been sick, because every time I didn't drink I got sick. And I didn't feel great the next day, but I didn't have any of the symptoms that I normally did. I didn't have the shaking. I had a little bit of a fever and my stomach hurt, but nothing like what I thought was going to happen. And the doctor told me, you know what, Dave, I'm going to send you to the detox ward. And you know, there they have AA meetings, and I'd highly suggest you go. And I want to thank H&I for what they do, because that's where I finally heard the message. You know, thank God for hospitals and institutions. Thank God for guys that come into to places like that and bring the message, because this guy came in and he told his story and and it sounded exactly like mine. And what he said was is he was hopeless. And no matter what he ever tried to do, he couldn't quit drinking. And when he quit drinking, he couldn't live his life. And he said that he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, he got a sponsor, and he worked the steps, and his life became amazingly whole. And it says in the 12 and 12, it says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And that's what I heard him say that day, and I bought it. For the first time in my life, I bought that there was a solution for my problem, because I always thought I was just crazy. I honestly didn't think there was a solution for my problem, and that day, I realized I wasn't crazy, that I had a problem with alcohol, that I had a disease called alcoholism, and that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous works on this. And I remember breaking down and crying from the deepest part of me, because I finally believed in something other than myself, because myself had constantly let me down. And I remember walking out of that room and seeing my dad and mom in the patio area talking to the doctor. And I never really ever saw my dad cry. My dad had tears in his eyes. And what he was crying about was the fact that he'd just been told that his son has alcoholism. And my dad's dad died of alcoholism. And every man on my dad's side of the family has died before they're 60 years old of alcoholism. And it was only a matter of time before I died of alcoholism. But luckily, I ended up over in a 30-day program, and I can tell you, I needed that. I needed a place to go for 30 days, because if I would have got left out of there, I don't think I would have made it. And while I was there, they had family night, and my parents would come, and I asked my dad if he wanted to go to an AA meeting, and he said, sure. And we ended up at Old Town Speakers. And at Old Town Speakers, there was a speaker speaking that night from L.A., and he was a great speaker, and he really broke down alcoholism well. And as he spoke, and the more he spoke about it, the more and more I realized that that's my story. And the more that my dad heard it, the more he realized that he had it. And somehow, some way, in that meeting that night, we realized that we weren't bad people, that we were sick people. And as long as we got sober, we'd be okay. And my dad no longer looked at me as this kid that didn't get things done. And he didn't look at me like I was a loser. And I didn't look at my dad like he was this angry man. I looked at him as a sick man with alcoholism. And he said, as you know, if we just stay in this program, we'll be okay. And all that resentment that stood between us melted away. And I walked out of that meeting and I felt like there was hope. And I went back to that rehab, and I called him, and I thanked him for coming, and he said, as long as you stay in AA, you're going to be okay. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, the nurse woke me up, and she said, your dad's had a heart attack. You need to go to the hospital. And I got to that hospital, and the heart attack was so massive, there wasn't any chance, and so they unplugged him for the life support system. And I knew at that point and period of time that God had just given me a spiritual experience through Alcoholics Anonymous, that was my higher power right there. That's all I needed right there, is something tangible to hold on to, because I know that if he would have died without that experience, I don't think I'd be sober today. And you know, it's brought me so far, and it's made me fully commit to this program, and I've had so many spiritual experiences as a result of believing in something other than myself. And I'd like to say that I jumped full into this program, but what I did is I went around Alcoholics Anonymous just going to meetings. And just going to meetings isn't the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the 12 steps that you do with another person. And thank God I ended up in this meeting in Alpine, and this Nazi AA freaking guru guy got a hold of me. And he I needed that. I needed a strong boot camp AA, and this guy was it. And he snatched me up and drugged me around Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got me commitments at every single meeting I went to. And we went all over the place, and we got in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I can't read and I can't write. And he said, well, guess what? You're going to read this book, and you're going to write what this book tells you to write. And both of those things happened. You know, I read that book with that man, and I wrote inventories out of that book with that man, and I had, experiences, and they changed me. And had experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous because I had commitments, and I had experiences in H&I, because right away I got commitments in H&I. As soon as I had 90 days, I was going into facilities and taking meetings because I felt like I had to give that back. And what ended up happening was, you know, a few years went by and my life got better. And I started taking guys through the steps, and that's where I really got it, is when I started giving it away. Because I don't think you really get this program until you start giving it away, until you sit and hear your first fifth step, and you hear everything that's wrong with you, every part of your life getting told back to you through another human being's problems. And I really realized what had happened. What I'd really realized is that, you know what, my relationship with my dad wasn't my dad's fault. My relationship with my dad was my fault. And my relationship with every person that I ever tried to have a relationship with wasn't them, it was me. I always stood in the way of having relationships with another person because I didn't have a relationship with myself, and I didn't have a relationship with a God of my understanding. And through the steps, I got a relationship with both. And as time went on, I wanted a relationship with a woman, and that hadn't been fixed yet. And as I said, you know, I tried to have relationships with women that weren't really ready to have relationships. And as I said, I met my wife in here, and she said, no, you know, I'm working on myself. And I think that's so interesting that she needed to go work on herself because she had to get some things worked out with her. And sure enough, about 3 or 4 months later, I was back in this meeting, and I sat down. I came in late, and I sat down, right next to her. And after the meeting, in the prayer, my hands are sweating, and I was all nervous, but I asked her out again, and we ended up going out again. And our first date was to an H&I thing where I was teaching how to do H&I, and then I took her to Starbucks, and we just sat and talked, and you know, it was amazing. And as we started to date, things grew, and one day she called me up and said, you know what, Dave, I'm pregnant, and I don't know what to do. And I said, you know what, I think I'm ready to have a child. And we ended up moving into that place up there in Crest that had burned down and rebuilt, and my daughter came into this world, and I was at Mary Birch when she was giving birth to her, and some problems started to happen when she was giving birth to her, and the cord got wrapped around the baby's neck, and I started to panic, and I felt like, you know, I wanted to run. I just felt so scared. And I looked out the window of that room, and what I saw was the intake hold of the 72-hour place that I had been in 5 years before that. And I knew that if God had brought me from there to here, he surely got this, you know, and I just surrendered to that and walked over and held her hand. And sure enough, we got in, you know, a doctor that came in and helped and got the baby out, and it was fine. And I just can't tell you enough of how many times I've had to surrender in this program. And that every time I do and I stand back and I just give it to a power greater than myself, things get better. And I have a beautiful daughter and a beautiful son today because of that. And just want to finish up with this story. So, you know, I really have done a lot of inventories on my dad and really tried to find that place where I'd, you know, not been in that relationship. But this summer, my friend came to me and he said, hey, I'm going on this hike. I'm going to go do this hike across the Sierras. And that hike that he talked about was a hike that I did with my dad when I was a teenager. And I really thought about it, and I said, you know what, I would really want to go. And it's a brutal hike. It's like 90 miles across the Sierras, all above 10,000 feet, going across Whitney on the last day of 14,000 feet. And it was hard when I was in my late teens doing that hike to do it. And in the time now, I wasn't sure, but I went on it to go do it with my dad, and every time when we left, as I hiked with my dad, I just realized how much my dad had taught me, and everything that I thought that man didn't know came to me, and as I hiked with him, I just grew with him. And I was hiking this pass, and I was talking to my dad as I was walking, and this cloud came over, and I started to cry, and as I cried, the cloud rained upon me like he was crying unto me, you know, and I just realized that, you know, he's with me, and all of that stuff that I didn't work out between him in that 8 days of hiking just went away, and I realized that he taught me so much, and he made me grow so much, and that this program has taught me to be able to go out and relive and redo all of those things and peel those layers of that onion away so I could be the man that I am today, you know, and next summer, I'm going to go do the whole John Muir Trail with him because I really think that it's important that I grow with it, you know. And as being a dad, he did a darn good job because it's hard to be a dad. And, you know, he did a whole lot more with me than I do with my kids. And I want to be that man that he was. And I learned that as I walked with him. And I learned how much that man tried to teach me. And I'm really grateful because without Alcoholics Anonymous and all of you, I would have never learned all of these things, and I'm so grateful, so thank you.